I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Kelly Flatley and Brendan Sinnott, the co-founders of Bare Naked, a food company known for its granolas and natural cereals. Kelly and Brendan started the company in their early 20s, and Bare Naked is available nationwide in stores like Whole Foods and Costco and online at barenaked.com. Welcome, you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica.
So I wanted to start off understanding how you both met initially.
Well, I think it was back in the hallways of our middle school in Darien, Connecticut. He was actually selling candy out of his locker, and we weren't exactly best of friends in middle school. And then I remember getting an invitation to your graduation party senior year. And I was so flattered, and because I was a year younger, and I was being invited to celebrate his graduation. And I remember that party just kind of being a blast and being a little bit sad that you were going off to college.
And then for like 4 years in college, or 5 years, 6 years probably, we didn't even see each other.
No.
Maybe like once or twice.
Kelly, what did you do between college and starting Bare Naked in 2002?
I sort of dabbled in a couple of different sports marketing internships. I've worked for Sports Illustrated at the Australian Olympics, and then again in Salt Lake City for the Winter Olympics. I looked at it from a like a long-term standpoint and recognized that it wasn't going to be fulfilling 5-10 years down the road. And in order for me to get the level of satisfaction I wanted out of a career and out of life, I looked myself in the eye and said, you got to do something else.
And why granola?
Granola was something that I made for myself simply because I believed in the fact that if I ate it, I'd feel better and I'd perform better. I intuitively, I think, have always understood that there is a real connection between what I eat and how I feel and how I function. So to that end, I just really relied on eating healthy foods in college. And the granola was actually one of those foods that I made myself.
And Brendan, what were you doing from college until you started Bare Naked?
I graduated in 2000. I went, and that was kind of during the tech boom, so I went to work for a software company in Austin, Texas.
Where did you go to college, by the way?
Vanderbilt.
Okay.
Worked at a company called Trilogy Software, which was so fun. They recruited like 200 kids out of college. It was like the prototypical tech boom where we had like ski boats we could go on. They had parties every week for us, but we did no work. And so we all had a very good time, but they eventually laid us off. So I came back up to New York, and then I went to work for Saturday Night Live. And I worked in the talent department there. And then I was on hiatus from SNL from the summer, and that's when I ran into Kel and heard the name Bare Naked. And I was like, oh, brilliant. And, you know, the rest is history, I guess.
And so at what point, Kelly, when you said, okay, I want to start this business, did you think, you know what, I want to bring Brendan on board as my co-founder? How did that work?
I think I was about 8 to 10 weeks into making batches, putting it on the shelves of local stores, and I was baking it through the night and then delivering the next day. So I would wheel in all of my ingredients into the back of a local kitchen, which was a commercially certified kitchen space. So I would do that at about 8 p.m., bake until 1 or 2 in the morning, and then turn around and sell everything I had made the night before the next day. Truthfully, it was getting to be really tiring. I wanted to be able to share some of the work and also some of the excitement. When I ran into Brendan, he was the first person who really expressed raw enthusiasm for what I was doing. At that point, it was so in its infancy, and I got more raised eyebrows than I did good looks. He was really the first person who said, can I come to the kitchen with you? And that seemed really strange that someone would want to come to the kitchen at night when they could be going to a local bar with friends. And then the next day it was, well, let's go on a sales call together. Let's go to local stores and pitch to organic and natural markets, farmers markets. We did that.
I was like, why are you doing it this way? Let's do it this way. You're wasting so much time. Well, you know, let's go to Walmart. Let's buy some bins. Let's set up an assembly line. It was addictive because every day you would put in this work and you'd come up with this new idea, and it made your life easier and it made the business bigger and it made the concept a greater idea. And it was so exhilarating.
Yeah,
for those
it was
first
a rush because we were growing so quickly. I mean, we were getting new stores every day, and I was able to use to focus on the things that I was good at, and I recognized instantly what he was the areas where he was talented, and those complemented each other really nicely without it being much of a planned effort.
this, in a way, seems like a marriage of convenience, in that, like, you both knew each other from high school, and, oh, it's just so convenient we happened to run into each other at this time. But what were some of your concerns at the time about Brendan coming on board as a partner?
It became clear when we started working together that he had a very strong personality and that he was really opinionated.
It becomes clear in the 2 minutes of this radio show, in fact.
Before that, it wasn't so obvious. He is very resourceful. I always think that's one of his best characteristics. He'll get something no matter what the cost. And I'm a little more reserved than that. So I appreciated the ambition, and I thought to myself, this could be a really complimentary partnership. At times, I think, you know, he did stretch the company to a point that it became sort of a stressful state. But it's amazing the way that people in our organization acted so well under the stress, and how it was almost a motivating mechanism. And
every
we
year
figure out a way to do it. Yeah, every year.
Every year we've consistently beat it.
When you saw that he was super aggressive, did you say to your parents, you know what, I'm not so sure he's the right person for this?
Everybody
or what was that dynamic?
Everybody said not to partner.
Yeah, everyone said.
Everybody.
Mm-hmm. We were warned. I think we were warned independently, and then we were warned together not to go down this partnership road.
After we had kind of decided that we wanted to partner up, we would go to the local people in our area and say, you know, can we help? You're an expert in marketing. Can we talk to you about it? Can you help us out? And they're like, you're partners? Like, I don't even want to talk to you. Like, you guys are going to blow up in 6 months. Get out of here.
Why were they opposed to it?
Kelly and I have been blessed for whatever reason to be able to work through it. I mean, we've had our struggles. There's no doubt about it. It's a relationship,
sure.
Right? And it's no different than a marriage or a father and son or friends. And the only times we've ever gotten really in trouble is when we stopped talking.
When was that?
Oh, it was 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And we put our company through, you know, when you have, we have about 32 people in our company today. And when you, and we lead the company and we're the faces of the company. And when we're not stable, everybody feels it. They can sense it in your actions and your emotions and how you look at each other. And so we have to be very sensitive to that. You never want to fight in front of your children, right? I mean, it's an age old rule. And I think we've tried to do the best to kind of suppress some of our own needs in the hopes of that we would project a better image to the organization and, you know, to our employees.
Yet still children and employees pick up
the
body language.
Yeah, and the vibes that we send out, even though we don't intend to and we don't want to, they naturally get picked up by those that are in offices next door to us and just the organization at large.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Brendan Sinnott and Kelly Flatley, the co-founders of Bare Naked, a healthy snacking company that sells granolas and natural cereals to places like Whole Foods and Costco's around the country. What's an example of something that you disagreed vehemently about?
Can I go?
Where do you want to begin?
We were designing our website, and again, that was Brendan's idea. I thought that we didn't need to invest in a website so quickly. I thought it was more important for the product to be available in stores, but he was very pro developing a website and getting that launched. So I agreed to it, and we decided that it would be best if we put pictures of ourselves up on the website to show our consumers that there really are people behind this whole enterprise and that it's real and authentic.
Well, and we knew very early on that we could never compete with Kellogg's or anybody like that, and so we needed to build our identity into the brand.
So in terms of, you know, pictures and images that really represented us best, I wanted to go take pictures down at a beach.
You originally wanted to take, like, pictures of, like, nuts and fruits and stuff and stick it on there.
That's right. And then, as well, if we were going to use pictures of ourselves, we should be in the great outdoors. And Brendan wanted to position ourselves in such a light that was, quote-unquote, bare naked, which involved showing a little bit of skin, and there was nothing offensive about it, but I wasn't totally comfortable with it. And he thought it was a brilliant way to sort of market the company.
I just wanted a response and wanted it to be memorable. Your idea was to, like, wear vests and wear no T-shirts underneath the vests. Like, that doesn't get anybody's attention.
So Brendan won that little argument because on the website, you guys are kind of bare from sort of the chest up.
We just wanted our consumers to ask the question.
Well, I'm sure your consumers also ask the question whether or not you've ever dated. So have
We're
you?
Talking business here, not personal
we
stuff.
We are, but it's all interwoven, as you know.
Should we tell her?
You can go ahead and let the cat out of the bag. We are friends with Bare Naked Benefits.
Yes.
I haven't said that in ages.
That's very well said. I like that bon mot. But what does that mean? Does that mean that you have dated or that you are dating or have they intertwined at all?
I date Kelly's best friend from high school. And I've been dating her since Bare Naked started.
Since 2 weeks after Bare Naked started.
Well, at least we got that off the table.
For anyone who's wondering.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Brendan Sinnott and Kelly Flatley, the co-founders of Bare Naked, a healthy snacking company that sells granolas and natural cereals to places like Whole Foods and Costco's around the country. So I want to go back to the Bare Naked beginning. When, Kelly, you said that you were in a commercial kitchen, how did you find that commercial kitchen?
It was actually just a friend of a friend who owned the facility, and it was the back of a local market in Rowayton, Connecticut. As soon as I realized I wanted to, you know, put the wheels in motion and get this business off the ground, I called the state of Connecticut and I said, do I need to be approved? Do I need a license? And they said, well, you have to cook in a commercially certified kitchen space. That's kind of the number one rule if you want to get products on the shelf. And we were in that kitchen for about 6 months before we outgrew it.
Did that kitchen make you take yourself more seriously, or did you feel that you became more disciplined because you knew that you could only work from, what were your hours?
It was about 8 or 9 p.m. to about
2 or 3 in the
morning. 2 in the morning. In terms of professionalism, I felt like it was real. And being in that kitchen at night with the clock ticking, and I had to get, you know, 50 pounds out the door that night, it was a rush. And I remember those moments being really, really sweet. I had the radio on. I had my 50 pounds of oats. And, you know, pots and pans were banging around in the kitchen. It was bliss. There were nights that were just wonderful. And you feel like, you know, I'm making this food and I'm going to feed someone.
From purchasing the products, physically making them with your own hands, taking it to the store yourself in your own car, putting it on the shelves with your own hands, feeding it to the consumer at the store, and then them taking it home was just it was such a wonderful kind of cycle to be in. And I think back to those moments of being in the kitchen with the music blaring at night at 12 o'clock when all our friends are calling us from the bars, and we were having so much fun.
What was the music you were listening to?
Dave Matthews, Coldplay, Counting Crows.
My guests are Kelly Flatley and Brendan Sinnott, co-founders of Bare Naked. We'll hear more from Brendan and Kelly coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Kelly Flatley and Brendan Sinnott, the co-founders of Bare Naked, a food company known for its granolas and natural cereals. Kelly and Brendan started the company in their early 20s, and Bare Naked is available nationwide in stores like Whole Foods and Costco and online at barenaked.com. You were the initial employees in the company. It was just the two of you doing everything. But what did that really mean?
Early on, when it was just he and I mean, we were the distributors. We were the brokers. We sold. We made the product. We did the accounting. We cleaned our offices when we had one. We were it. And that sometimes requires 7 days a week worth of work up until 11 o'clock at night when you just don't want to look at another oat. You know, you've got to keep baking. I remember a lot of times we go to running races in the area, and when athletes finish the race, we're there at the finish line to feed them some Bare Naked and re-energize them. And so that entails, obviously, bringing a ton of product, sample cups, spoons, coolers of yogurt, banners, balloons. We really want to create a fun environment for these folks after they finish a race. Brendan had a 1983 Jeep and didn't have a top at this point. So what we did is we filled the Jeep with all of the materials we needed in order to make this a successful marketing event, and it didn't all fit. So instead of, you know, getting a top for the Jeep like we should have, we shrink-wrapped the car with stretch wrap and drove down the 95 across New York City into Long Island with a stretch-wrapped vehicle.
That's great.
I vividly remember going over the Whitestone Bridge with, like, the Jeep totally filled up, and it was so loud because of all the stretch-wrapping and people, like, honking their horn next to me, saying, like, when it was pointing at it, thinking it was going to fall off.
And then that night, I think, sleeping either four or five employees to a room. I mean, we used every inch of space that we had.
In the beginning, out of our first seven employees, six of which went to Darien High School, the seventh was my college roommate. And so, you know, for the first two or three years, I mean, it was seven college kids just on the road going to have a good time. And we'd be five or six in a room, you know, going up to Rochester for an event. And then we'd all, you know, work all day, go have a good time that night, and then go pile in the car, go to Buffalo. And it was like a two-year road trip. It was really fun.
we made the most impact when we were on the road. And there was only so much we could do Monday through Friday, but Saturday and Sunday were the days that we just nailed it. We got to see consumers. We got to go to retailers. Occasionally the press would come to the event and we got to see those folks. And that's when the action happened.
How much do you think your age has helped in terms of setting yourself apart? Like, oh, wow, those kids were only 23 when they started it.
I think it was a big asset for us. I think people really felt when they saw our passion and saw our enthusiasm, saw how hard we were willing to work, they were willing to help us.
And we were so green, I think they just really wanted to help.
You know, we never really bought any capital equipment for the first 2.5 years. We would go in and we'd call all the different local people and say, hey, listen, if you have capital equipment and you're not using it 24 hours a day, can we use it at night and we'll pay you and it's just extra money for you guys? And that's how we made all of our product for the first 2 years.
And I remember one day when we were operating the business out of my parents' house, we were going to make several batches of granola that night. And so we ordered in a bunch of food from a distributor. The truck showed up in my parents' driveway. And they unloaded, instead of raisins and almonds, they unloaded dog food and tofu. And we were like, what are we going to do? We can't use either of these products. So back to, you know, Wild Oats we went, and we were emptying all the bulk bins in the center aisle, making sure we had just enough raw materials to get through that production run. So we really had to kind of turn over every stone in order to get it done.
And on the raw materials front, distributors wouldn't sell us ingredients because we didn't have good credit and we weren't a big enough customer. So we're like, well, how do we get almonds? How do we get honey? So we used to go to the local Costco and literally we would go out, we'd have those big carts and fill the entire thing up with almonds or the entire thing up with honey or canola oil and be pushing the cart out the door and got the weirdest looks from everybody. They're like, do you bathe in that stuff?
It took both of us to push the cart.
I mean, you're pushing like 500 pounds of honey out the door, and we ended up being like the Costco, you know, business of the month or
business
customer
member
of the month.
Of a month.
Because we used to buy so much stuff.
Awesome. And by the way, you know, this dog food with tofu delivery might just be another Bare Naked product for pets.
There you go.
I want to talk about your first customer. How did you break into the market on a large scale?
I think the first couple customers that we had were really, really small independent customers. And basically, the fact that we used to go buy sandwiches there when we were kids and that we used to buy groceries there got us onto the store shelves there, and we made it work. And then our first big jump was to a place called Stu Leonard's, which is a three-store chain in the New York metro market. And it's this great, wonderful, innovative supermarket. And that was going to be our first big break. And the way we got in there is we called the buyer for months and months and months saying, hey, listen, we're local. Give us a chance. We used to shop here as kids. We, you know, got no love. And then we eventually just kind of decided one day we're going to bring the buyer breakfast in bed. Because we're like, how do we get his attention? And so we, Kelly and I got up one morning very early, like 6:30 in the morning, and got like her mom's tray and her mom's china and got some fresh fruit and some Stu Leonard's yogurt and some Stu Leonard's milk. And we wore matching jean and t-shirt outfits that said Bare Naked. I mean, just so cheesy.
We were the first car in the parking lot that morning. We were the first ones up in the office.
And we get up to the office and we're like, hey, you know, is the buyer here? We brought him breakfast. And the receptionist is like, well, that's really cute, guys, but he's actually on vacation. And we were just like so deflated. But then at that moment, Stu Leonard Jr. walked by and we're like, Stu, we brought you breakfast. And we shoved the tray in front of him, and he spent a couple hours with us that morning, took on the product. And then when he took on the product, I remember it was in May of 2003, for about 3 weeks straight, 5 days every week, I went to Stu Leonard's and sold the product myself to the consumers. So it was really important to us that once we got in that first opportunity, that we wanted to, you know, you make the sale really one time, and then after that, you're really just selling your prior success. So we made the sale to Stu Leonard's, and we did everything in our power to make sure it was a raging success there, because that raging success then led to a local newspaper article about our success at Stu Leonard's, which led to the next chain following.
You're right. It's one thing to get into the store, and then it's another to really nurture it so that you perform well, because he would kick you off the shelf as quickly as he allowed you on.
So many food companies I see fail, and they fail because of that reason. They think they get on the store shelf, and they think they're done.
It's like you got to be careful when you get married. You still got to work at it. It's not mm-hmm. like just because you have the ring on your finger, it's done.
Of course. Even, you know, the Stu Leonard's break was a lucky one. I think it was right at the point where we needed something to happen in the business. But the coolest thing about Stu's was also the fact that it was really our classroom for learning about the food business. I spent time on the loading dock. I worked with the managers. I even backed up a U-Haul truck myself and unloaded product. And it was just neat to see the process from A to Z, how you sell a product into a grocery store and how it ultimately gets on the store shelf.
Because we were so cash-strapped and because we had no success and because we were starting from scratch, it forced us to kind of crawl on our hands and knees along the whole process and really learn it backwards and forwards, which allowed us, as we got larger, to kind of understand what levers to pull within those organizations to get McBear Naked successful.
Were there ever any potential customers who were trying your food that said, you know, I don't really like this? Like, what was some of the customer feedback?
Oh, we got rejection left and right. I mean, and when we were in the stores, I would never say, do you want to try some whole grain granola? I would say, do you want to get Bear Naked? And, you know, they'd say, what's Bare Naked? I'd say, well, it's the best way to start your day. Well, what do you mean? And I'd say, well, give it a try. And then, you know, then let's talk about it. And because granola had such a negative connotation, and, you know, it was kind of think of Birkenstocks and Vermont or something like that. And so we had such a different spin on granola. We never wanted to call it granola. We wanted to call it Bare Naked. But consumers, when we were launching the product, it was right during the Atkins boom. And so everyone's like, oh, I can't have any carbs. And I'd sit there and be like, you're going to die if you don't eat carbs. Like, you need to eat fats and you need to eat carbs. Just eat the right ones and be smart about it and exercise.
Did you ever put off anybody, like an 85-year-old grandmother, when you said you want to get Bare Naked?
I think they were the most excited. Nobody has said it to them in a while.
I'm Jessica Harrison. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are the co-founders of Bare Naked, Kelly Flatley and Brendan Sinnott. What is the history of granola?
Back to the 1800s.
Yeah, Dr. Kellogg from Kellogg Cereal. The first cereal he ever invented was actually called Grunola, which was a baked blend of grains with honey. And that was the first cereal. And then for whatever reason, for the last 100 years, people have ruined cereal and processed it too much and put too much sugar on it. So we're trying to take it back to its roots.
So your packaging makes you stand out to some degree. It's very bold, and it's in these fitted bags. Was that something you knew you wanted from the beginning, or what was that process like?
I think early on, when Kelly originally packaged the product, she had it in a clear cellophane package, and the product looked so beautiful. But after kind of twist tying, about 1,000 twist ties a night, and then hand tying little hay pieces on there, it got a little old. So we eventually found something that had a zipper on the top of it that was clear. And we're like, oh, that's perfect, because, you know, we wanted the consumers to actually be able to see the product, which is very different than a lot of other cereals. They get hidden in boxes.
And I think the package also accurately reflects what Bare Naked values. We're simple. It's clean. The ingredient declaration is everything that you can pronounce. There's a message from Brendan and I on the back of every bag. So, we're accessible people. It's bold. It's refreshing. It stands out. It's youthful, and I think those are all things by which you can describe Bare Naked.
I want to turn to capital. How did you guys pay yourself for the first 2 years of the business?
We didn't. For the first 2 years, that was kind of the big sacrifice. We were able to do it because we both moved back in with our parents. And so for the first literally 2 years, we didn't pay ourselves maybe about $500 a year.
One retailer actually paid us in cash, $100, and we split it. I was like, this is our annual salary. We got $50.
Because we were so young and we had no real responsibility except to ourselves. We didn't have to take care of any kids, house payments, car payments, anything like that. We totally mooched from our parents. We utilized credit card debts. I remember I was doing the accounting for the company on QuickBooks, which I still don't understand to this day. And consistently in the checking account column, it was just negative like $110,000, negative $130,000 every day because I wasn't balancing everything properly and we were overdrawn from the bank. And we had a great local banker that, you know, we'd call up and say, hey, Tom, I promise we're doing okay, but can you just let this check clear? And it was those kinds of relationships that let us get by.
Which credit card company were you using? Was it?
Which one weren't we using? We American Express, Visa, MasterCard, all of them. And the big thing that we did is we would rack up all these bills, and then we didn't have any money to pay for them. But what's so wild is the credit card companies, after the first of the year, because so many people spend a lot of money during the holiday season, offer 0% financing if you transfer balances.
Ah.
So we would always do a big transfer of all the balances in the beginning in January or February.
Look at you. And was this your personal credit card or now the company's credit card?
No, this was all Kelly Flatley's credit card. I don't think you had good enough credit to get us.
I had plenty of it. It was ruined pretty quickly afterwards, but we had it. And to this day, our name's still on the hook for all the loans that we have.
What were your parents feeling about this? I mean, it's one thing to say, yeah, go ahead, start this little adventure, but then to eat away at your credit, which really stays with you for life, you know, did they feel differently?
You don't tell them those things. I mean, I had savings, and I think I had, you know, maybe $8,000 in savings from my prior jobs, burned through all of it. I cashed all my savings bonds that my mom had given me as a child, and I cashed those. I never told her about it. But it was just like you needed some spending money. You needed to go out to dinner once in a while.
Did you flirt with venture capital at any point?
We did. We were actually, flirt's a good word for it, because we almost started dating with those folks. We sort of entered into discussions with them, and 30 days after we started talking to them, we had a real good understanding of how they would impact our business and what it would mean to us personally and professionally. And we were almost about to close the deal with them. And then I actually remember we sat down in your mom's living room next to the fireplace. And he looked at me and I looked at him and I was like, can we do this? Are we ready for it? Is it the right thing? And we just had to ask ourselves really, really deep, difficult questions. And, you know, the crux of which was, are we ready to give up control? And we both realized that the money wasn't worth it.
And at that point, we said no to the venture capitalists. And then they came back to us 2 months later and said, oh, we'll give you twice as much money now. And so we learned the power of saying no to that point. And then I said, well, why don't I just say no again and see what happens? And so we said no. And also during that same time, we tried to seek out so much counsel from folks around us that understood financing. And we were dealing with terms. I remember going up there and negotiating with the venture capitalists, and they'd have six people around the table, and it would just be me. And they're talking about a term sheet and convertible debt and all these different technical financial instruments, which I had no idea what they were about. And, you know, some person that was close to us said, hey, Brendan, you know, the best thing in the world you can do is just say no to them and walk away. You know, you're such a success in this area. I feel confident you can go get the money from friends and family and keep your own company. And Kelly's father always says to us, you know, your ability to hold on to the company is equivalent to your tolerance for pain. And so we were willing to take a little more pain and continue with the risk and try to find the money from another source that would allow us to keep control.
Now, where did that source of capital ultimately come from if you didn't go to the venture capitalists?
It came from all friends and family. And it's been the same really group of investors that we've been able to deal with. And they've just been, you know, I think we've been very happy on both sides of the equation.
Talk to me about competition.
In retrospect, I don't think we ever picked our heads up and checked out the competitive landscape until we were asked by our investors, well, who are you guys up against? And we were like, well, the people next to us on the shelf. I never really given thought to who they were. I just really wanted to be on the shelf, and I thought I could outsell whoever was next to me. But it was interesting. That question was never brought up by either of us in any of our marketing discussions or anything. It was only when we were asked by people who were going to invest in our company.
So, Brendan, you're the CEO now, and Kelly, you're the president. Do people, you know, who think they have a lot of experience say, oh, you guys should turn the company over to more experienced managers because you're still in your 20s? I mean, Do you face opposition? Do you say, no, I feel like I can do it? Or do you say, well, you know what, maybe they're right?
They say it every day. It fires me up. I love it. It's what kind of gets me to work every day, just to prove that I don't need your help. I can do it. But, you know, we've brought in, you know, over the last 6 months, probably 7 people, all with 10 to 15 years of experience. And what we're trying to do is just make sure we're not the smartest people in the room.
What are sales today?
Because we're private, we don't disclose our sales. Mm-hmm. But within the marketplace, people are buying this year between $75 and $100 million of bare naked from retail stores.
Now, Brendan, it's an understatement to say you have a lot of confidence, but what are some of the mistakes that you've made in the company? Give me one example.
Oh, I'll give you a big one. Big one recently is advocating the responsibility of operations. We didn't necessarily have the right people in our operations group, and we went from operating out of one facility to 8 facilities. And I thought everything was kind of taken care of, and I didn't look at it. And operations isn't my most favorite part of my job. So I just kind of put it to the side and didn't really focus on it enough. And it's gotten us into an issue where, you know, we need to be able to make a lot of product and we don't have the ability to make it.
I think from a day-to-day standpoint, he does a really good job of keeping all the balls in the air. Sometimes his communication with the organization at large isn't perfect in terms of content and tone. And I think sometimes that has an irritating effect on some of the people. They want to know what's going on. They want to be told what's happening and when it's going to get done. And they want to be spoken to in a certain way. And I think sometimes in the haste of getting work done and meeting deadlines, he's really quick and doesn't always think right before he speaks. If that's his biggest fault, he's doing all right.
We don't mean to pick on you.
Oh, no, I love it. It's like therapy.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you,
thank
Jessica.
You.
My guests have been Brendan Sinnott and Kelly Flatley, co-founders of the granola company Bare Naked. Coming up, we'll hear from Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They were the pioneers behind making chocolate from the actual bean to the bar, and they're part of a group of food artisans who produce their own cheese and chocolate and knives and meats, and they're part of a local barter community in Williamsburg. Welcome, Michael. Welcome, Rick.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Before we get started, I just want our listeners to know what I'm looking at, which is two brothers who have massive beards. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how long it's taken you to get your beards to the length that they are.
Well, originally, we sort of made a wager with ourselves when we first decided to do this. We made a wager that after we would make and sell successfully 1,000 chocolate bars, we were not going to shave. And by the time that happened, we were sort of accustomed to them, and they were sort of part of who we are, and we thought it sort of symbolized what we do, so we keep them, much to our wives, my wife and his girlfriend's dismay. Yeah.
We held true to that, and it took about maybe 8 months before we sold our first 1,000 bars.
How would you describe what Mast Brothers Chocolate is?
Well, simply we describe it as American craft chocolate, a sort of term that goes beyond just being a slogan. Just taking pride in one's work as a craftsman or a craftswoman, you know, that it's not just for my brother and I, but it's for the people that work with us in our factory. It's also just people that work in our community, in our food artisan community, and beyond food artisan community. It's being a part of a community of furniture makers. You know, there's a resurgence in furniture makers. There's a great knife maker in Brooklyn. There's all sorts of great cheese makers, beer makers, wine makers. So whether it's, you know, from woodworking to food, it's a sort of self-dependence and a pride in what you make with your hands.
Rick, before you were making chocolate with Michael, your brother, what were you doing?
I was working in kitchens and restaurants all around New York. Worked briefly at Gramercy Tavern, worked briefly at Soho House, worked briefly under Jacques Torres.
Gramercy Tavern, which is owned by Danny Meyer, the restaurateur, and Jacques Torres. He's a chocolate maker.
So what we do is make the chocolate that maybe someday he would use to make his confections with. We are the tree grower or the logger to somebody else, to a carpenter's, you know, creation of something they would make with wood, you know.
And before you were working in the culinary life, what were you doing?
Before that, I was a classical musician. I studied piano and composition and was obsessed with opera. And I always dreamt of actually using a similar approach and mentality and vision to what we're applying to chocolate with opera. I always thought that opera was the ultimate liberal arts education. That's what I'd always say. You can learn everything about life by working in an opera.
Why do you say that's the case for opera, and how is that then carried on to your making of chocolate?
Well, with opera, you're learning about languages, you're learning about history, you're learning about physical building of sets, you're learning about math with the composition of scores, you're learning so much, and you're working with the team, all of that. Well, I think that, what you just learn about the necessities of life, food, shelter, music, art, those are the things, family, friends, those are the things you need in life. So to sort of be a proponent of it that, and really push it out there to the public about how beautiful it can be and how important it is and how pure it can be. It doesn't have to be so complicated. That's important to me. I'm not sure if I made sense there, but I tried to in a roundabout kind of way.
I think it
I'll does.
Buy
it.
How did you decide to go from opera to chocolate?
Well, it was opera to food, music to food. So my brother was living in New York. I was living in California at the time. And I decided to move out to New York and crashed on my brother's couch and started getting into food. Started first, just briefly worked at a local restaurant in Williamsburg, and then decided after about a week or two of that I need to study and really work at this like I worked at classical music. So then I went to culinary school.
Michael, what were you doing before starting this company?
Well, I originally came out here after I graduated from college in 2001, and my goal was to work in independent films and maybe one day be a film producer. And so my path was working in production and in financing and accounting for different films or TV shows.
You're both from Iowa. What did your parents do in Iowa?
Our mother works for the dean of the graduate college at the University of Iowa, and our father passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, our father was a carpenter, and but he fought in Vietnam and went through the shit, as they say. So he had lots of problems, and our mom was always sort of a champ and raised us on her own. We have an older sister as well.
What influence did you have from them, if any, in the path you chose? I mean, yes, your father was a carpenter, so there's that obvious link with working with your hands.
Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I think that what our mother taught us was self-reliance and work ethic. I think that it goes beyond stereotype that Iowa boys work harder than everybody else. Mike and I have a sort of unwavering work ethic that we wake up, no matter how much we fought or how whatever happened in our personal lives, we'll always wake up and get the job done and work, you know, pretty devastatingly exhausting hours.
What was that moment when you both said, Rick, you're living on Michael's couch, and you said, okay, we're going to start this chocolate company. How come it wasn't cheese or milk or butter?
Well, I think that it could easily have been cheese or butter. I'm interested in all of them, and we both are interested in all of them. It was chocolate specifically because chocolate is probably far and away so associated with American culture because of such a favorite food of Americans. And so when we were searching out, we're like, oh, how is chocolate made exactly? After learning about how to make cheese and all these other things, chocolate was the next on the list. So how do you make chocolate? Well, let's go ask. So we'd go to shop after shop after shop, and they'd say, how is chocolate? I would ask them how chocolate was made, and they would say, well, we put the chocolate in this tempering machine, and then we make these, you know, various shapes or bonbons or truffles. And we're like, no, how is the chocolate made? Chocolate doesn't grow on trees. It's a recipe of, it's what happens after you make something. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized, no one knows and no one is doing it in all of New York City. New York City? So we were just like, wow, this is insane.
Why do you think no one else in New York City was making chocolate from the bean?
Well, I think that from a business perspective, the profit margins aren't exactly through the roof. You could make a lot more money selling truffles and bonbons and confections than you can making it from the bean. It also, there's no such thing as commercial equipment for it. You can't say, I'm going to start a small chocolate company and then go online and get a couple machines. Almost all the machines that we started with were made for something else. For instance, our first granite stone grinder that we used was made to grind rice, and it was sourced from India. And we had to do some alterations to it for it to be used for chocolate. So it truly is a start from scratch, including the equipment.
We talk about how craftsmanlike you are, and it seems like such an ironically novel concept, you know, in the 21st century, when really you're just getting back to the very fabric of human existence, and it's amazing how far we've moved from that.
It's incredible, yeah. People go on, now they go on Brooklyn food tours, and people come with their cameras around their necks, and they're like, look, these people are making chocolate from scratch. We're going to go to the butcher and watch him butcher meat. Wow. You know, it's like...
We really just wanted to simplify everything, too, and that's why we're so open about what we're doing and how we have an open factory, just so people can really see what's going on, and there's no mystery behind it, or there's no mystery in the ingredients or the process.
Could you just walk me through briefly the process? How you are going from bean to bar?
We source our beans currently from Madagascar, from Brazil, from Venezuela, and from Dominican Republic. We also have a relationship with some farms in Belize. And when I mention these countries, it isn't just a country. We have specific farms from each country. After we get the beans, we actually just have a big butcher block table. We spread the beans out on there, and we sort through them by hand. We literally go through each bean and anything any piece of bark, any piece of just empty husk, any stone, we sort out. After that, we roast the beans. It's a very delicate roast. And we roast in an oven that we got from a restaurant called Marlowe & Sons, which is sort of a community hub for food artisans. And we just traded it for chocolate. So it's just really awesome to live in a community where that's possible.
To barter.
Yeah, exactly. After that, we crack all the beans by hand. We took an old piece of an old grinder or mill that is commonly used for breaking up barley when you're making home brew, when you're making beer. Then we have to separate the husk from the bean. So we collaborated with a friend of ours who has a business in Red Hook. He's actually an engineer, like an aerospace engineer. So in his, you know, in his side project, for while he's building equipment for satellites, he's just a young guy like us, you know, that's up to no good, you know. So he is collaborating with us to build this winnower, and by winnower I mean a contraption that separates the husk from the meat of the bean, and it's beautiful. After that, you have the cocoa nibs. So,
and the nibs are what are inside the husks.
Absolutely, yep. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis, the foundation of all chocolate. So we have these beautiful granite stone grinders, which is basically a mechanized version of the old way that people may have seen in encyclopedias or books of Mayan women are putting have a granite roller over a granite stone, and they're just going over the chocolate and combining it with cane sugar or vanilla bean. Large commercial companies use stainless steel, and we just find that the stainless steel will basically almost burn out the flavor. So we do a slow 3-day grinding process. Then we add the sugar. We have a very specific sugar philosophy. Each bean gets treated with a different sugar just for to construct perfect flavor profiles.
When you say each bean, you're saying each bean from a country.
Right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, or each varietal. Our mentality is that, for instance, Madagascar has a very sort of citrusy, almost like a sour cherry flavor to it, a little bit of a raisin flavor to it, kind of winey. And I love that acidic, pure, clean flavor of it, and I don't want to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you necessarily need to use that raw sugar is always going to be the perfect pairing. So in this case, we use something that's a little bit more refined, something that provides sweetness, but not a lot of distracting flavor.
Walk me through the process of coming up with the name for your company. Were you considering anything else?
I think it was pretty, we knew it right away.
I've taken some business classes and in the food industry business classes and stuff like that. And they would always say, you know, whatever you do, don't involve your name in the company, because if it goes down, you don't want your name to go down with it. There's no accountability or responsibility for anything. So that is what I think is so important about calling our company Master Brothers Chocolate and really taking the responsibility of being the face of it. The Master Brothers has other more personal and intimate implications, and that's that our father and my uncle, they're always known as the Master Brothers, and they used to just raise hell in their small town in Primgar, Iowa. And they're infamously the Master Brothers, much to their now ex-wife's dismay. I think that we also wanted to get back that name.
Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of working with family. When you were first starting out, for example, did you know how you would get along?
On the subway ride over here, my brother and I were talking about what really is it about working with family that draws you together, and what we came up with that you'll never fight for anybody harder than a family member, and you will never fight harder with anybody but a family member.
Well, we had been living together for a few years before we even took on this venture, or even had a notion that we'd be starting a chocolate company together. But we had that time of about 3 or 4 years of having many fights. You know, not just mental fights, physical fights. And you know, we got through those, and we still have those on occasion.
Is there a theme to the nature of your fighting?
We don't fight over what we say to each other more so than the way we talk to each other and the tone of how we talk to each other. And
it's always the tone. It's just the tone.
And then that just brings up, you know, past arguments or fights that we need to steer clear of.
And of course, it's always his tone that's wrong, not mine.
Definitely always Rick's tone.
Because we know that we've survived so much, like, together, just growing up, and also just we've lived through arguing about way worse things than a chocolate company. Mm-hmm. So if we've survived that, we can survive anything. But that also opens the door to more arguments, mm-hmm. because if you think about the psychology of that, if you know somebody that you work closely with, that you know that you're going to live to see another day, no matter how you treat them, you might take advantage of that sometimes.
That's right, because you know you'll never lose them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we mm-hmm. cross the line more often than we should. And
welcome to therapy on NPR.
Exactly.
And also, we just had some extreme successes. We are now the restaurant Per Se is using our chocolate, and
Per Se is one of the leading restaurants in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And we have such respect for Thomas Keller and his crew that to me, coming from that from a restaurant background, is like a dream come true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, and we're so busy now that we used to be able to celebrate each of these new things that happened. So a couple of years ago, we would, celebrate
after selling 30 bars at an artist market,
like we did, really, you know. And so now we have these beautiful new things that are happening, and we don't have any time to celebrate them because we have the next thing to do, and that really takes a toll. You know, you never just get to breathe and just, oh, that was nice, you know.
Do you have any grand visions for what you'd like the company to become, or are you taking it more on a kind of incremental basis?
Definitely an incremental basis. It's that we've been very dedicated to that and are sticklers to that, because already we've had many, many opportunities to grow super fast and build a huge factory off-site somewhere and all this kind of stuff, and we've deliberately turned it down. When we first started, we were very dedicated to slow growth. Just like food should be made slowly, with care, a company should be built under the same manner.
It's kind of like your beards.
Yeah, exactly. Slow growth. Yeah. Slightly annoying and hard to deal with it many times. It is like a beard.
It's my impression that the way you our living is very close to the way that you want to live. Is that an accurate depiction or impression that I get from you just based on the company that you're building and the website and just my interaction with you, that there's less of a distance between the way you're living and the way you want to live?
I think so. I think that's definitely accurate. I think that part of that might be just the way we grew up, being very content with what you have and appreciative of what you have. You know, we never summered anywhere. We never even heard of the word summering. So we've never desired anything like that, you know. So there's an appreciation for, A, for hard work, for working hard. And so since we're doing that, then we're pretty content. We were joking. I was joking with Stephanie, who works with us, about how I was telling her how I just finished organizing my pantry with my wife, and everything is like in these nice mason jars. Everything is divided up by, like, you know, grains, pasta, all this stuff. And so she started thinking, wow, so your life is, you're making chocolate, then you go home with your wife and you, like, look through your beautiful pantry of old-timey mason jars and all of this stuff. And I said, I had to stop her. I'd be like, whoa, wait. It's not, we'll, you know, we get Chinese food with the best of them, you know what I mean, when we're exhausted. So, you know, we have cable TV, you know. So...
thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
My guests have been Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.